This edition of Farming the Countryside is brought to you by Pro Farmer. Pro Farmer provides key information to help farmers make profitable decisions. Go to tryprofarmer.com for your free trial today. Welcome to Farming the Countryside. I'm Andrew McRae. About 3 years ago, we visited with former Secretary of Agriculture Dan Glickman about a new book he had just written at the time. Many of his thoughts then still hold true today. I thought it'd be a fun look back to hear him talk about life, agriculture, politics, and more. It's our topic for this week's Farming the Countryside, and it's brought to you by Pro Farmer. Start making confident marketing decisions with Pro Farmer. Pro Farmer's condensed style is designed to save you time while giving you the important information you need when making those important marketing decisions. And you'll stay on top of profit opportunities with Pro Farmer's mobile sell alerts and easy-to-use mobile app. With spring planting just around the corner and a new crop ready to go in the ground, now is the perfect time to start a free trial. Get insights on marketing the grain you may have still in the bin and get ready for the season ahead. Plus, gain insights on the ever-volatile livestock markets. Start your Pro Farmer free trial today. Just visit tryprofarmer.com. That's tryprofarmer.com. We visited with former Ag Secretary Dan Glickman 3 years ago. He had just written a book, and we had a fun yet sobering look at the state of agriculture and the country. Some things change, but a lot of things stay the same. I was recently thinking about that interview and thought it would be nice to bring it back to you this week. We took a look back at his life, some of the highs, lows, and laughs along the way, and his view on what's taking place in the country. I think you'll enjoy hearing some of his stories from his time as a U.S. representative, cabinet member, and life after politics. In particular, he recalls when he was the designated survivor during the State of the Union address, a unique role that takes one cabinet member outside of Washington, D.C. in case the unthinkable happens. It turned out to be an interesting time when you were the focus of attention to suddenly not getting any attention at all. Here's our conversation. Former Secretary of Agriculture Dan Glickman joins me, and he is laughing at himself. At least that's the title of his new book, his Education in Congress, on the farm and at the movies. I'm excited to have this conversation, and we'll cover a lot of ground here. But first of all, Mr. Secretary, thanks for joining us. Tell me about how and why the new book now. What inspired you to begin writing and sharing some of your stories?
Well, I would not be telling you the truth if I just decided this in the last few months. I've been working on this for a long time, but I decided that now is the time for a couple reasons. One is, I've been frustrated, frankly, with the toxicity in American politics, although things seem to be getting a little better in the last few months, but how humor is so important as part of our American life, and how our politicians today are rather humorless. And so I thought I'd write a book about my own experiences and the various things that I've done in my life, and how self-deprecating humor has both helped me and gotten me out of trouble. And I thought it might be useful for people, both political people and non-political people, to maybe learn about some of those experiences.
Well, I think it is. Certainly the book lends itself to some advice, perhaps for all of us in today's world. I want to go back to, let's go back maybe to the early 70s. You know, you're beginning to run for Congress, and as you describe in the book, you are a Jewish kid growing up in a pretty conservative state, and you are going to end up running as a moderate Democrat, and of course, you win in 76. Do you think you could win that type of race today because how politics have changed? Describe the climate, because you were out there knocking on doors and really connecting with people, but how would Dan Glickman be able to run today versus in 1976 when you guys started?
You'd have to run a revolutionarily different campaign. First of all, today it's money, money, money. So when I ran for Congress in 1976, my campaign over a whole year cost about $100,000, and my opponent, who was a then sitting congressman, spent the same. Today you'd almost have to spend $100,000 a day. I mean, you'd have to spend $3 to $5 million to run this kind of race, which meant that you couldn't go door to door like I did. I walked 35,000 to 40,000 homes and walked to rural areas, because you have to be on the phone raising money all the time. And then the other thing is that I ran as kind of a moderate centrist Democrat in a state that leaned Republican. And today I just really doubt that I'd be able to run in that capacity. Today you have to either be way on the left or way on the right to secure your party's base in order to win a primary to get into a general election. Well, when I ran, I could run as a in the middle, because that's where, by the way, most major decisions are made, and build bridges with the other party. And it's just harder to do today.
It certainly is. And, you know, in the book, you talk about that quite a bit, and how humor helped you through that. You have several stories about, you know, you didn't necessarily grow up on the farm every day, but yet you used humor and even your Jewish background to really break down a lot of barriers and connect with farmers and folks in agriculture, plus a lot of other folks as well. But that humor really helped you break down those barriers, didn't it?
Well, you know, it's very funny that I tell a lot of stories. I remember I went out to West Texas early in my career, and when I was a secretary, and they hadn't had rain for months. And I think they may have had a half inch of rain in Lubbock over about a 4 month period of time. And so I took some meteorology courses in college. And so I could see that maybe there was a low pressure trough moving through. So I spoke to a group of people and I said, I smell rain in the air. And that night they had 3 inches of rain. And the next morning, I met a bunch of the county commissioners at the breakfast, and one of them said, "Well, now we know why they call your people the chosen people." I said, "Trust me, it wasn't divine intervention." But anyway, I learned to kind of use humor in a positive way, and I also found it very easy in farm country and agriculture country. It allowed you to be yourself, allowed you to be authentic. And today, a lot of politicians, I don't think, have those attributes.
Do you think that is because, as you mentioned, the polarization of politics, but could a person who wants to take that route and really try to be a consensus builder, somebody in the middle, is it just simply too hard for them to get elected now? And if so, how do we ever get back to where we were? Because it looks like our country right now certainly needs some people that can bring two sides together.
Well, I think it could be done in a couple of ways. Our congressional districts have been so gerrymandered that they are very safe Republican or safe Democratic districts. So what happens is that if you run for office, especially in the primaries, you don't have to appeal to people on the other side. You just have to appeal to your own base. And that means that you get, to use a football analogy, you're always between the end zone and the 20-yard line on either side, as opposed to being between the 40-yard line and the 40-yard line. So if we could make redistricting more open and more bipartisan, then people would run in districts that would have a closer representation of Republicans and Democrats than we do now. And that way you'd have to appeal to the other side more. I think members of Congress today are just as good and talented as they've ever been. But the system of how we redistrict our congressional districts, coupled with the amount of money in politics, coupled with the nature of the media today, which is you either have media on the right or media on the left. There's not much media in the center. And I think that causes divisions that I didn't see 40 years ago.
You know, by the time we got up to 1994, and certainly we're going to get into your term as Secretary of Agriculture, how much had politics changed simply from 76 to 94? You talk about that in the book, but certainly the climate had changed, and simply how people looked at different issues and the media and their involvement and so forth. A lot had changed by the time you got to 94, hadn't it?
Yeah, I think that, there was just an explosion in the amount of money in politics occurred in the mid-'80s, late-'80s, early-'90s. So, even my own race in 94, which I lost, I spent about five times as much as I did when I ran the first time. And then a lot of social issues became really bigger issues like gun control and abortion, these issues were not such big issues back in the 70s. They became much bigger issues, you know, in the 1990s. And then we started to see the nature of the media changing. Social media, use of the internet, and that really didn't happen until maybe around 2000. But it started, when I ran for office, there were three networks and local newspapers. And local newspapers were really critical places where people would get information about what was happening in the world. And today, you just see the demise of local papers, or if not the demise, they just don't have the resources to communicate with people like they used to have it. And that hurt, because when you didn't have local coverage, all you get is national coverage, which tends to be very divisive.
In 1994, you lose a race, but you perhaps gain the job, as you describe, maybe of a lifetime. Were you surprised when you get a call from Leon Panetta and the White House that they want to make you a member of the cabinet?
Well, I would have given up my House seat voluntarily to become Secretary of Agriculture, because that's a dream job. But, so when I lost my race, I had about 2 or 3 days of depression. And then my dad said, get up, get out of there and start looking for a job. And so as a parent who was raised in the depression, he didn't have any excuse for just hanging around and being depressed. So I was looking for a job, but Leon Panetta was the White House chief of staff, and he and I were elected the same year, and Al Gore was the vice president, and he and I were also elected in the same year. We're in the same class. So the then Secretary of Agriculture, Mike Espy, had announced his resignation, and so President Clinton was looking for a replacement. So Gore and Panetta knew me from Congress, and they recommended me. And then I had the support of Bob Dole, who was the Senate Majority Leader at the time, who was strongly impactful in getting me that job. And it all happened within like a 2 to 3 week period of time. And timing is everything in life. And in this case, I was, unfortunately, Mike Espy went through his problems. He was largely exonerated. But, I just had the right people. Garth Brooks has this song, I got friends in low places. Well, I had friends in high places, and they were the right friends, you know?
Right. Well, in 94, then you become the United States Secretary of Agriculture. At that time, when you took, stepped into that office, what do you feel like were some of the biggest issues there? You know, you mentioned in the book that was just the beginning of some of this talk about organic farming and GMO. Certainly they'd been around, but that was just beginning to get big. What were some of the biggest things that were confronting you when you stepped into that office?
Well, I'd say that we went through a period of low commodity prices, and it wasn't quite as bad in 1995, but it got really bad. I remember that poultry prices were depression era levels. So we had a period of fairly low prices and had to deal with that. We had natural disasters, floods, droughts, that kind of thing. Organic and the GMO issues became big. And, you still see some of those issues, although they're not quite as big as they were before. And then I had this issue involving discrimination against African-American farmers, which during my years in Congress, I had really no knowledge of, and that became a big issue that I had to deal with. And then finally, food safety. We had some E. coli and salmonella outbreaks, and people died, and there was a whole resurgence of the government involved in food safety activities. USDA is a great agency. It has amazing jurisdiction over and the final thing, I'm sorry to ramble a bit, is the U.S. Forest Service. Well, I'm from Kansas, and I would have to tell you, well, we have some trees in Kansas. We don't have very many forests at all. And the Forest right. Service is the largest part of USDA. It has 40% of the workforce of the Department of Agriculture. And so I had to deal with a whole litany of timber cutting issues in Alaska and out west and in the south as well. And I had to really speed up my learning process that I had not engaged in during my time in Congress.
Sure. You know, I jotted down some things that I wanted to ask you about, because it's certainly called laughing at yourself, and you had plenty of things where you could, you know, sit back and chuckle. January 20th, 1997. Tell folks why that's important, because was that as close as you got to the presidency in some ways, the January 20th of 1997?
You know, I could have been president if there had been a national catastrophe. But and then I told my wife this, and she said, "Well, good luck on that one." You know, your spouse is always telling you what you probably don't want to hear. But so every State of the Union, they have a designated survivor, and they pick a cabinet secretary, usually not state or defense. They usually pick what I say one of the more important cabinet departments, like Department of Agriculture. So they picked me, and I had to leave Washington, and I went up to New York to visit my daughter, and I had the military with me, and a contingent of about 8 or 10 people plus Secret Service. And so we went up there, and I watched Bill Clinton give his State of the Union message, because they don't want you in Washington in case there's some horrific attack that takes place. They want you outside. So Bill Clinton is prone to making long speeches, and his speech was supposed to be 40 minutes, and I think it was about an hour and 40 minutes. And after it was over, I took my daughter to dinner, and the security left because I said I didn't need them any longer. And there was this giant sleet storm in New York, and we got out, and there were no cabs, and there was no such thing as Uber or anything else. And we walked about 13 blocks in a sleet storm back to her apartment. I commented, I said, you know, 3.5 hours ago, I was potentially the most powerful man on the face of the earth, and we can't even get a cab, you know. So it's a good lesson about life. The ups and downs can come when you don't expect them.
You know, you mentioned in there that the designated survivor that they have whenever there's a State of Union address has most often either been the Secretary of Agriculture or the Secretary of the Interior. Is that right? They've been picked the most?
Yeah, and Ag and Interior have been the most, but Commerce has been up there as well. And of course, it's a different world today. This was pre-9/11, so I don't think that the Secret Service and other folks gave as much a thought to the actual reality that the entire government would be destroyed in some massive attack. And so my security was there was security there, but it wasn't like it is now. I mean, I can tell you now they have really upped the game on the designated survivor, and they protect that survivor much more than I was protected. Plus, they now have a designated survivor, I think, for Congress as well. So it's a different world today.
It is. It is. You know, another fun story was playing golf with Bill Clinton. Did you learn to not do so well when you played golf after your first time shooting well against him?
Well, when you when they called, President Clinton's office called and said they wanted to know if I wanted to play golf, and I did. And so I went and played with him. My dad told me, whatever you do, don't beat him. Don't beat him if you want to keep your job. So we played golf at Andrews Air Force Base. And I played golf in high school in Wichita, but I'm not a great golfer, mid-80s or something like that. And so, but the first hole I got a par, and the second hole I holed it from 175 yards, a par four, and went in the hole. And everybody started screaming, and I thought we were under attack. And the first thing President Clinton says, well, let's make sure that's your ball in the hole. And so I got a two. And then the next hole, I got a birdie. So I was par, eagle, birdie after three holes. And then I pictured my dad saying to me, don't beat him. And so the next six holes, it was double bogey, triple bogey, double bogey, triple bogey. And so I ended up okay. But I've seen him every time I see him. I don't see him all that often. He says to me, he says, how's your golf? Got any more eagles lately? And so he hasn't forgotten.
You know, I'm interested in your reflections on President Clinton. I had a chance to meet him, and you talk about that ability to connect. And, you know, certainly folks have different politics, and that colors how we decide to look at different presidents and so forth. But you certainly served with a president that could connect with people, and you talk about that quite a bit in the book.
You know, he's the kind of guy that would look you right in the eye. A lot of politicians will be looking around, seeing who else is there. Maybe somebody's more important. And, you know, I know he wasn't a perfect president. He had some, obviously, some personal issues that that plagued him. But on a one-on-one basis, I never met a man who could engage people from the very poorest to the very richest. It didn't matter to him. You know, he treated people, extremely well. He was also kind of the proverbial good old boy. He came from the small town in Arkansas, and he probably knew more about agriculture, farming, and rural America than any president in modern history, and maybe even since Lincoln, because he grew up in that environment. And I remember that he used to, when I would see him, he would ask me, what am I going to do about the rice loan rate? Now, I'm thinking to myself, can you imagine any president asking his agriculture secretary what he's going to do about the rice loan rate? And so I had to bone up a lot to be there. But it was useful to have a president who knew and understood agriculture and rural development. I think that's been fairly rare.
You know, to kind of wind up, I want to go back to where we started. You mentioned about the era of politics that we're in now. Give me some hope, because I think a lot of us feel like that things have changed a lot in the, you know, however long we want to talk about here. And we wish that we could all come together, whether it was as politicians, but just as Americans. It seems like sometimes we have a lot of arguments, and maybe they get into social media and all different types of places. But, you know, I know that you established even a center for political humor at Wichita State to maybe help us through some of this. But what would you have to say that gives me hope that, hey, we can do this, and what we should all be doing to try to make that happen just as American citizens?
Well, you know, I was very lucky, because in Kansas we had Bob Dole, Pat Roberts, and me as federally elected officials or federally appointed officials at the same time. And we were all involved in agriculture, but we all had pretty good senses of humor, and we worked across the aisle. And it was a model that I think other people used to see, that, you know, that we could work together. But I think we just need to lower the rhetoric, the level of hostility. And then I worked when I was at the Aspen Institute with lots of younger members of Congress, newer members of Congress. Most of them are just as highly qualified as they ever were. There are a few strange ones in the group, but I think our political system is still pretty resilient.
Mr. Secretary, I appreciate the time. Your book, Laughing at Myself, My Education in Congress, On the Farm and at the Movies. I'm sure folks can find that wherever books are sold, as they would say. Is that right?
And at the University of Kansas Press, it's a place they can get it. And your local bookstore probably will have it. Hopefully they'll have it. So, and of course, Amazon has everything. But, wherever they can get it, I think it's a fun read, if nothing else.
That's right. Well, Mr. Secretary, again, thank you so much for your time and sharing about how a little laughter helps us through a lot of life, but even politics and your life as well.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
As I mentioned in the open, our conversation with Secretary Glickman took place in 2021, but many of his thoughts and experiences still ring true today. No doubt some things have changed, but thinking back to how he and other notable Kansans on both sides of the political aisle worked together, it's a notable example to us today. I will say that if you enjoy history and agriculture, his book is an interesting look back at the national and world scene from the 1970s up through the early 2000s. And as always, as Secretary Glickman's book title says, he's willing to laugh at himself, a good quality for all of us to have. Thanks for joining me on this week's show. Remember, you can follow Farming the Countryside and our daily show, American Countryside, on Facebook, Twitter, or X, Instagram, YouTube, and TikTok. Just type in Farming the Countryside or American Countryside. You can also get updates from both of these shows by following me on LinkedIn, if that's your preferred social media platform. Also, you may want to check out TotalTownMakeover.com. That's our site devoted to resources and examples of communities in rural and agricultural America taking steps to improve the places we live, work, and call home. There are several great stories there about how each of us can do small things that can have big impacts. So I hope you'll check out TotalTownMakeover.com. And remember, you can hear these shows in a variety of ways as well at FarmingTheCountryside.com, on many local radio stations, or on your favorite podcast platform. If you miss one of our shows, just use those platforms to go back and catch other topics of interest as well. We try to have a variety of guests who provide information impacting many parts of the ag industry and rural America. I'm sure many of you listening to this are like me and have had unseasonably warm weather for several weeks. That's certainly the case for our farm. It makes you feel like it's time to get the planter out and put seed in the ground, but realistically, we're still a month away on our farm. I appreciate you joining me on this week's show. I'm Andrew McRae. I'll catch you next time on Farming the Countryside. This edition of Farming the Countryside has been brought to you by ProFarmer. ProFarmer provides key information to help farmers make profitable decisions. Go to tryprofarmer.com for your free trial today.